Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here. And from
New Hampshire Center for Cognitive and Behavioral Therapies, providing outpatient, evidence-based, specialty behavioral health and substance use disorder services. NHCCBT.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. President Donald Trump's Commission on Election Integrity meets in New Hampshire amid debate about its real and stated purpose. A new voting law, SB3, which critics call a voter suppression tool, goes to court. A shooting at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in Lebanon leaves one person dead, and racial tensions are high in Claremont after the alleged attempted hanging of a biracial boy. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we will talk about them this hour. And we'd like you to lend your voice to this conversation. What about this week's news do you want to know? What perspective can you share that will help your fellow listeners understand the issues? You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange at nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU and author of the website NH Political Capital, Dave Solomon, reporter from The Union Leader, and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Great to be
morning.
Here.
And just a reminder to our listeners who really want to see us, we are broadcasting via webcam today. You can see a live stream of this program at our website, nhpr.org, and of course at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We're going to start the show talking about the meeting held at St. Anselm College of the President's Commission on Election Integrity, and we want you to weigh in on this. So give us a call now. Again, the phone number for you is 1-800-892-6477. Okay, Dean, so let's talk about the context of this meeting. It was the commission's first meeting outside D.C., and it was controversial in part because of Chris Kobach, the committee's co-chair. He made some inflammatory comments before the meeting. What were those?
Well, he published an article in Breitbart, the right-wing news website that's been in the news for a long time now because of the Trump campaign and Steve Bannon, his advisor, who has now gone back to running Breitbart, and he's actually a paid columnist for Breitbart now. Also running for governor in Kansas, and he wrote an article saying that the fact that 6,500 individuals voted in New Hampshire's election with out-of-state driver's licenses, and that the vast majority of them, roughly around 5,500, have not since then changed their licenses to New Hampshire licenses, that that's evidence of voter fraud. And we know that voting in New Hampshire with an out-of-state driver's license is perfectly legal. It tends to happen in college towns. There's some good work that's been done by NHPR on that, that the vast majority of out-of-state licenses were used in places like Durham and Manchester and Keene and Hanover. And so he said this was evidence of systemic voter fraud in New Hampshire. And so that was kind of the initial controversy that set us up for this meeting this week.
And then following that, the publication of that article, there were calls for Bill Gardner, New Hampshire Secretary of State, who is on the committee, to step down the congressional delegation, calling this commission a sham.
Yeah, you know, I've certainly have been very critical of the commission on this show in the past. And, you know, Bill Gardner said he was not going to step down, that simply disagreeing with others about the nature of voter fraud is not a reason to step down for the commission. You know, and my argument all along has been that, you know, Secretary of State Gardner's motives for doing this may be admirable. He has said there is no widespread voter fraud, but he believes there are doubts among voters about the integrity of our voting system, and he wants to explore them and kind of let the chips fall where they may. But the problem is that this is taking place within the context of a commission that is stocked with a number of people who have a kind of a track record of pressing for proposals and reforms that some people believe are voter suppression. So, you know, my concern has been all along, it's fine if he wants to explore this. This particular commission is probably not the best way to do that.
And listeners, if you want to weigh in on that, should Bill Gardner step down? Should he remain on this commission? Give us a call. What do you think should happen with this? 1-800-892-6477. Lines are open. Jeff, what do you think?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that what Dean said, I agree with what Dean's saying. And really, at best, you could describe Chris Kobach's article in Breitbart as just signaling his intentions. That's the best way you could say it. I mean, you could also say he's just got his mind made up.
Well, what are those intentions? I mean, is he trying to sort of shore up support in Kansas as he runs for governor?
Well,
that
you have to remember that he is running in Kansas, which has a whole different kind of politics than New Hampshire does. So we don't understand that.
His position is elected.
He's an elected official. Exactly.
New Hampshire,
yeah. He's elected. Secretary Gardner is elected by the legislature. But the thing is that he's already said he's had an interview with the Associated Press where he's already said there's a high possibility that there will be no recommendations coming from this panel. So it's in a way, it's just these going to be these hearings where he's going to go around the country, gathering evidence from sides that, you know, from people that are basically self-selected who are going to give information about potential fraud and people we've heard from before over the years, the Heritage Foundation, other places like that. And in the end, he's saying, well, we might not even come to recommendations. So then he's saying, well, what's the point of these hearings if there's no if there's nothing happening, why are we doing this? Why are we getting everybody all worked up about potential election fraud without being anything being done about it?
Dave Solomon.
Good political theater.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And we had some great run-up to the political theater. It would have been compelling enough as it was set up, but our Speaker of the House managed to sort of accelerate the or intensify the situation by releasing this, frankly, very well-known data about the election patterns in New Hampshire on the eve of the visit. This notion that these 6,500 votes were cast and that they were mostly from the college towns and that there did not result in subsequent automobile registration was released as if it was some remarkable new finding.
Yeah, it moved around social media like an aha moment.
Aha moment, which was almost like Jasper putting the ball on the tee for Kobach to knock out of the park, which he then proceeded to do. This was all well known. I mean, I wrote an article about 2 months ago, or maybe a little further back, when this SB3 debate was raging, documenting the number of votes that were cast by out-of-state ballots, out-of-state licenses, and where the states were that they came from, mostly Massachusetts and Connecticut, and debating all of the nuances associated with that. So that was really nothing new. It did intensify the theater. So you had this chain of events. First, this release of this well-known data comes out, sets Kobach up to write a column. He writes a column, sets our Secretary of State up for criticism by his fellow Democrats and sets the tone for the meeting whereby everybody in the audience is waiting to see if Secretary of Gardner will defend the integrity of the state against the challenges of this opinion piece written in Breitbart News. And the anticipation of it was so keen that in the opening remarks, Kobach actually had to say, we will be addressing that in the second part of the program.
But they did eventually get to it, and Secretary of State Bill Gardner addressed Kobach directly during the commission about that piece. Let's hear what he had to say.
The problem that has occurred because of what you wrote is that the question of whether our election, as we have recorded it, is real and valid. And it is real and valid.
So, Dave, you covered this. What was the response to that?
There was mild applause from the audience. I think most of the response by those who favor these election reforms was that the Secretary of State was polite and his response was appropriate in that context. Among those who opposed the law, the many students who were there protesting, the Democrats and so forth, they thought it was kind of tepid. And many of those in the room felt that throughout the day-long event, the Secretary of State from Maine was far more aggressive in his questioning of the panelists, particularly those coming from the three or four groups who've spent the past decades promoting the notion of voter fraud across the country.
The other point I'd like to make is that this panel is put together by President Trump, who is the original person who said that, who's basically claiming that there was fraud committed in New Hampshire. And he was the one who said there were busloads of people coming up from Massachusetts, with thousands of voters voting illegally, which we know is not true. And the whole idea of the commission was set up by a person who has said, I want you to show that I want you to show everybody I'm right. And we already know that he's not right, at least in New Hampshire, and I would assume probably everywhere else. But I mean, that's why people responded to Secretary of State Gardner's remark, because he has been hesitant in basically questioning the validity of some of these claims.
So given what you're saying, Jeff, and based on what Dave was just saying, is a polite response what's required in the face of a commission like this?
I wouldn't say the Secretary of State has been mild in rebuking the claims that there's voter fraud. He's been very unequivocal that he doesn't believe there's widespread voter fraud in New Hampshire. He's never been a big voice for the notion that there's a lot of illegal voting taking place anywhere. His position has been and continues to be that the perception exists, and so actions must be taken to reverse this perception, which creates kind of a chicken and egg scenario whereby the forces who believe in voter fraud continue to promote the perception that it exists, and then the argument is put forth that laws need to be created to reverse the perception.
And that's why his appearance on membership on the panel is problematic, is because he's basically giving some credibility to these people who are saying there's voter fraud.
And he's saying that voters have some concerns about the integrity of the system. Those concerns in large part are being driven by the kinds of people who are on this commission and the arguments that they've been making, as Dave said, for many years. And Secretary of State Gardner's motives may be admirable, but I continue to not understand why he thinks this particular commission at this particular time, given what Jeff just said about, you know, Donald Trump trying to reverse engineer an explanation for his loss of the popular vote, which he blames on illegal voting, you know, why he thinks this is the way to do it, or why he thinks this is a good idea. Anything that comes out of this commission is just not going to be taken seriously by a pretty significant chunk of the electorate. There will be, you know, sort of particular group of voters who are going to say right on. But, you know, we're going to continue to deal with this sort of issue of attempts to legislate based on ideas about voter suppression that don't bear out empirically. And I think that's a problem. And, you know, in the end, this stuff always ends up in court as a challenge to a civil rights issue.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We're talking about President Trump's Commission on Election Integrity and their meeting here in New Hampshire. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking about SB 3, the controversial voting law that some say is a right-wing tool to prevent likely Democratic voters from coming to the polls. We'll also be talking about racial tension in the Upper Valley after the alleged hanging of a young biracial boy. Call us now to get into the discussion on any of those topics. The number is 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We've got another bit of tape that will help us understand what happened on Tuesday at the Election Integrity Commission's meeting. Jason Kander, former Missouri Secretary of State and president of Let America Vote, which is a nonprofit designed to fight voter suppression, addressed the controversy over Secretary of State Bill Gardner's participation on this commission. Let's hear what he had to say.
Secretary Gardner is a professional. He's someone who's well-respected among the community of folks who administer elections, and I'm offended on his behalf at the things that have been said about elections here in New Hampshire. You've got a commission here that was formed, really, originally, to justify the biggest lie that a sitting president has ever told, which is that there were millions of illegal votes in the election.
So that's Jason Kander, former Missouri Secretary of State, weighing in on the issue of Bill Gardner. And Jeff, you mentioned earlier that Chris Kobach, co-chair of this commission, said that there may not be any recommendations. But even if there are, there's no obligation for any state to follow them.
No, absolutely not. That's exactly to what Dean's point was, that, you know, this and also Dave's, is that this is just a political theater. And it's being these hearings are being held to gin up the emotions, the feelings among a certain group of voters, to convince them that, you know, we're fighting your fight, and we're going to expose everything. And what they're exposing is, as we know at this point, they're exposing nothing.
They're exposing
things we already know, which are just, and they're just you know, manipulating those numbers and facts and to try to support their argument.
The process, as we said, continues to drive voter concern about the system. And now, you know, so far we had been talking primarily about you know, President Trump and why he lost the popular vote. But Kobach extended it to the Senate race between Maggie Hassan and Kelly Ayotte, which the difference was about 1,000 votes. And so now it's kind of sort of spread, and you know, that's not healthy either.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, we do have to acknowledge that New Hampshire does have a problem, which is every election, hundreds or thousands of people register on the day of the election or shortly thereafter without identification and sign an affidavit attesting to their domicile. But then when the postcard is sent to that address to verify that they live there, hundreds of them are never returned. Exactly what that means remains to be decided. The Attorney General has never been able to investigate them to a sufficient degree.
Yeah, the problem is that it's not necessarily fraud. The problem is we just don't know.
We don't know.
Right. Okay. 1-800-892-6477 is the phone number to join this conversation. And let's talk to Kevin in Concord. Kevin, you're on the air. Thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I understand that John H. Sununu is on that panel, and I think that's a direct conflict of interest because he's a very biased Republican. And I don't think that whole issue would get a fair trial, so to speak.
Thanks for bringing that up. Actually, let's clarify that issue, because John H. Sununu was there.
Right.
He weighed in, but he's not actually an official member, right, Dean?
Right. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah. He's not on the panel. He was at the event.
There was an awkward moment when the last results of the last gubernatorial election were put on the board, with Sununu beating Van Ostern, and one of the panelists congratulated the father of the governor for his win.
I should mention that the Exchange did an excellent show yesterday morning on SB3 and on the Voting Commission. Casey McDermott, Dante Scala really laid out a lot of these issues, so I encourage listeners to check out the podcast on that. It really covers all of this ground quite thoroughly.
Yeah, SB3, we're going to talk about that briefly now and then again after the break, but just bring us up to speed, maybe, if you could. Dave, what is SB3 and what were the provisions of that law?
Well, SB3 is an attempt to ensure a greater review and greater accountability on the part of people who show up on Election Day or within a 30-day window of Election Day to verify that they have a domicile in New Hampshire. And if they can't produce any of the documents that prove they have a domicile in New Hampshire, they have to sign a lengthy affidavit and promise to bring those documents back to the town hall within 10 days. 30 days if you live in a small town without a lot of hours at the clerk's office. So, and they're signing a statement that says if you don't come back within these 10 days, you're going to be subjected to significant financial penalties and potential criminal prosecution.
Significant financial penalties in this case meant up to
$5,000. Yeah, you couldn't remember the exact amount. So this is very different from the current process, which says you sign a form that says you live here and we'll send you a postcard, and if you don't send it back, nothing much happens. So this is an attempt to, in a way, not only ensure that these people without proper identification are subsequently verified, including the threat that local officials, including police, might come knock on your door if we don't get this paperwork back. This is not just an attempt to ensure greater verification, but to potentially discourage someone who is not a resident from voting when they realize that they will be held accountable to such an extent. I think that's the intent of the law.
And we've got much more to say about Senate Bill 3 after the break, and we want you to weigh in as well. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and Dave Solomon of the Union Leader. We'll be talking about out-of-state voters, what that means for New Hampshire and its voting law. We'll talk about what happened in court with SB 3 this week. If you'd like to weigh in, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You could also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. This is NHPR's weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, and we will be right back.
This week, NHPR's Something Wild explores the intertidal zone, that place between high and low tides.
And this is a difficult place to live. Twice a day, you are pounded by waves and then exposed to sun and wind.
Doesn't sound so bad on a warm September afternoon, but imagine that constant barrage in November. Chris and Dave give us the lowdown on the creatures and veg that call this place home. Subscribe to Something Wild wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review. And we're going to be talking about SB 3 in a moment. It had its day in court earlier this week. We'll break down what happened there in just a moment. But also in this segment, we're going to be talking about what's been happening in Claremont this week. Racial tension is pretty high after the alleged attempted hanging of a biracial boy. If you'd like to weigh in on that story, call now to get on the line so you'll be ready when we have that discussion. That's in about 10 minutes or so. If you are a member of Claremont, how do you feel? How does this kind of event make you feel? Or if you have a similar story, if you feel like you need to weigh in some way, we'd love to hear from you. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email if you like, exchange@nhpr.org. All right, so let's talk about SB 3, this law that some say is aimed at suppressing the Democratic vote for the most part. A Hillsborough County Superior Court judge is allowing a controversial new voting law to go in effect, this SB 3, but it did make one minor change. Dean, tell us about what happened in court.
Yeah, this is because there was a special election up in the Laconia area, and the judge literally issued the order, I think, the morning of the election, right as the doors were about to open on the polling places. And he said he would leave the requirements in place, but that the penalties associated with the new laws were potentially obstacles to free and fair voting, and so he would not allow them to be put in place, the $5,000 fine, being prosecuted for voter fraud. You know, my guess is it's going to get a much deeper constitutional review now in terms of whether or not these penalties represent some sort of negative, unfair, or unconstitutional impact on people's ability to vote.
Well, help me unpack that. How could a fine of, let's say, the maximum $5,000 deter a legitimate voter from going to the polls? Is there a scenario under which this fine would deter someone?
I think that's the important aspect of the fines, because from the point of view of people who feel that people are voting who shouldn't be voting, it does no good if we allow them to vote, let their vote be counted, let it be part of determining the outcome, only to later find out that the address was not legal or that they were inappropriate voting. So despite the representations of the SB 3 sponsors that no one will be prevented from voting, which is true, it is certainly part of the intent of the law to block people who are not legitimate voters from voting through fear of these penalties. When you read something that says if you aren't back here in 10 days with certain documents, you could face a $5,000 fine and criminal prosecution, that might lead someone whose life isn't perfectly well organized and who thinks I might forget to come back in 10 days just to turn around and walk out of the building.
Okay, so
that is the scenario.
Yeah. That's one scenario. I mean, there could be others, but that's one.
And the other thing about the judge's ruling was that he basically he said that the penalties were basically could be a big deterrent to voting. But the other thing was he didn't like to give exactly a ringing endorsement of this bill, of this law, because he said that he cited some U.S. Supreme Court ruling about assuming a constitutionality of something if it's a constitutional question, but he left a big hole in there just whether this actually is constitutional, this law. So when it goes into further appeal, further litigation, I think that that's more of a question that would really be under discussion.
Mm-hmm. And Governor Sununu weighed in on this Superior Court judge's decision. Let's hear what Governor Sununu had to say about it.
I disagree with that opinion. But like we said, this is, you know, they've taken it to the courts. They want to fight it. But it's, again, just the first step. There'll be other legal steps throughout this process. Like could be the trial and an appeal and, you know, who knows where it goes from there. Again, the state will abide by whatever the courts ultimately decide as this goes forward. But we're very pleased with the results that we got today.
Okay, so certainly the battle is not over yet. If you'd like to weigh in on SB3, on the idea that there are out-of-state voters voting illegally in New Hampshire, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Buddy in Brookline. Buddy, thank you very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Good morning. I got a comment that I'd like you to touch on after I'm done. So if a person from Brookline applies to the University of New Hampshire to go to college, and they get to the box that says, do you live in New Hampshire? You check that box, and you get a reduced rate because you're a resident of New Hampshire. Now, the next town south of us, towns in Massachusetts, if a student from there goes down the box, do you live in New Hampshire? No, I do not. They check a box, and they pay a higher tuition rate than the person who lives in Brookline. So with that said, if we had our elections on the third week of June and not in November or March, then basically Kelly Ayotte would be in Washington today than Maggie Hassan. So I'd like to hear you discuss that.
Can I dig into you first?
Sure.
How do you know how people voted?
Because on the registration date, 9,000 students from the University of New Hampshire all registered to vote. Correct?
Yes, perhaps that's true, but let's assume that it is. How do you know how each of those students voted?
You're bashing me on the.
I'm asking you a question, sir. If you know how those people voted, I'd love to know how.
Well, you can't really refute that you wouldn't expect them all to be Democrats because it's kind of a whole Democratic thing at the colleges. It's
fair enough, but hard to prove a negative. I would like to make a decision based on some evidence.
I'll give you back that point, but try to refute that if we had our elections in June and not in November and March, that everybody would be home to vote.
Again, not quite sure about that. Let's put it to our panelists.
I would have to say, in fairness to the caller, it's fairly widely accepted that the university vote tilts heavily Democratic. But this argument continues to center around the legitimacy of out-of-state tuitioned students voting, and it is settled law in the state. You might not like the ruling of the judge in 2012, I believe, when it was determined in a court of law and not subsequently challenged or overturned by a higher court, that out-of-state students have a legitimate domicile in New Hampshire and are allowed to vote here, and that their dorm rooms or apartments they live in are legitimate New Hampshire domiciles for purposes of voting. And yet this continues to be debated as somehow the core of the issue.
And actually, if you could point it out, that you know, college students are spending the majority of their time in the state of New Hampshire, where they have an interest in how in what's going on in terms of their government, local government, state government, county government. So you could argue that they have every legitimate right to be voting. Right. It's not like it's not as if they're just giving some kind of thing to vote just to make people's life difficult.
Well, and if we had the election in the third week of June, you'd have college students who are from New Hampshire who go to college out of state coming home and voting in New Hampshire. And my guess is you'd get a similar result. You know, the issue here is this whole issue of voter fraud. There's a conflation of the debate over whether or not college students from out of state should be able to vote in a state election with the separate issue of whether or not the law is being broken. And as Dave said, it's settled law that they can vote in the state. So the problem is that's all kind of getting wrapped up into a debate about, well, college students typically lean Democratic, so Republicans would prefer that they not vote in state.
It's not only settled, but it's been settled against repeated attempts to achieve a different outcome. The state legislature has even attempted in recent years to pass laws that would require you to get an in-state registration for your vehicle after you've used an out-of-state ID to vote within a certain amount of days. And the courts have ruled that unconstitutional as a form of poll tax, requiring people to register their vehicles at a cost associated with voting. So you may disagree with these ideologically, but it is the law right now.
All right. Well, we should probably move on from this because we've got a lot of other news to talk about this week. And if you'd like to weigh in on what's been happening in Claremont recently with the alleged attempted hanging of a biracial boy, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And here now in the studio with us is NHPR's Brita Green. She's been covering Western New Hampshire for NHPR and has been deep into these stories this week. Welcome to the program, Brita.
Thanks, Peter.
So the city of Claremont doing a little bit of soul searching this week, and demonstrators gathered together to make a statement saying that racism is not welcome in their community. Tell us about the incident that prompted all this.
Right. So just before the start of this school year, allegedly a young boy, an 8-year-old biracial boy in town, was attacked by teenagers, a group of teenagers who started throwing sticks and rocks at him and then calling him racial slurs and then tying a rope around his neck and pushing him off a picnic table. This was later reported by his mother, who posted pictures of injuries to his neck on Facebook, and it has sort of blown up since then. That first came up in the news last week.
And we know this is a racially motivated attack?
What we have are reports from his mother and other members of his family who have discussed it. We haven't had official reports from the police or the Attorney General's office or anything like that.
But the governor has sort of elevated the investigation of this.
Right. The governor weighed in this week condemning racism and said that he's asked for regular reports from the investigation.
And so I've got a question here from Susan of North Woodstock, who's asking, has the chief of police of Claremont stated any clear opposition to racism and bigotry?
Yes, he has. So he spoke at a vigil earlier this week and says, you know, he can't comment directly on the investigation. It involves juveniles and it's ongoing, but he does condemn racism. And he says it's just a really difficult and tragic situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And meanwhile, the family has now set up a GoFundMe account raising what they hope will be $40,000 to pay for what exactly?
Right. So actually, the GoFundMe, so that's an online fundraising campaign, and it was set up by someone not in the family, but with the permission of the family. And that has raised thousands of dollars. I haven't checked the latest total.
The last I checked yesterday was $28,000, than $28,000.
Right. And I believe the money is intended to go to counseling for the young boy and his sister who reportedly witnessed the attack. So taking care of the family. Their younger sibling, the mother has a 1-year-old son, has been in Dartmouth-Hitchcock getting treated for a blood disorder. So the family's been under stress, to say the least.
Yeah. And so you covered the rally that happened earlier this week. What was the rally like?
Yeah, so it was interesting. So it was organized by a local resident. It happened around 5:30, so early evening. There were about 100 people there. And it was sort of a back-to-back faith leaders, some local officials, the police chief spoke, the city manager spoke. What was interesting about it were there were several moments throughout the evening where people sort of pushed back. So, pushed back against the anti-racist message. Or someone driving by called out, you know, stop making this about race. Someone from the crowd in the middle of it said, you know, all lives matter. That kind of thing.
Which is a dig on Black Lives Matter.
Right, right. Yeah. Why are you making this about black people, you know? And then afterward, just as I was walking back to my car, there was a pickup truck that was driving around the square, passing through town with a giant Confederate flag sort of waving off the back of the truck.
And go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, concurrently to this, another incident occurred in the Oyster River School District on a school bus just a day or so ago, where a 7-year-old biracial boy was apparently either verbally assaulted or attacked. It wasn't specific what happened to him by another boy on the school bus. And, you know, it's like, where is this coming from? You know, it's concerning. I mean, I think the governor's response is obviously right on. I mean, this is something that needs to be looked at and see why is this happening?
Yeah, and I would say that a lot of local activists sort of push back at that idea of where is this coming from, who say, you know, this has been a problem going back a long time, and it's just now that people are feeling comfortable sort of bringing it to the forefront. You know, at the rally, one of the speakers said, you know, this doesn't represent our town. And then an activist pushed back and said, to say that is, it's just clearly untrue. You know, how could this not represent our town when these incidents continue to happen?
And comfortable is kind of a hard word to use, because it seems like none of this is actually comfortable for anybody involved.
Right.
Well, right. It's interesting, you know, Jeff mentioned the other incident in that particular family, the older child that had some issues as well in middle school. And they said specifically they picked Durham as a progressive kind of university town. There, at least one of the parents works at the university and is a student there. And they were just been quite surprised that they have sort of encountered this here. Yeah.
And one of the differences between these two events, Ray, is that one occurred sort of within a school or within the purview of a school district, and the other one was not.
Yeah.
So Oyster River, of course.
One involves a police investigation, and the other one does not, if I'm not mistaken. I think it obviously.
Claremont.
And I think the part of the overall investigation that the governor alludes to, everyone hopes, will also include an investigation into the conduct of the Claremont police in their review of the matter, because if some of the things the mother has said are true, it certainly merits some explanation by the police department that can't be concealed under the cloak of this involves juvenile, because we're not talking about juvenile behavior there. We're talking about police behavior, whether it's true that their process of investigation included interviewing the victim at the scene in front of his alleged accusers. That simply would not be appropriate.
Breed, is this something you've heard about?
Right. There have been, the family has criticized the police investigation, has said that they decided to go forward with making it public because they felt like there wasn't enough action being taken. We actually have tape we can air from an interview with the uncle, with the young boy's uncle yesterday on a radio show in Boston. He spoke with the host there.
Meghna Chakrabarty of WBUR, speaking on a program called Radio Boston, was talking with the young boy's uncle, Lyric Merlin, when he was interrupted by someone at the door.
Hi, are you still with me?
I am. Who was that? What was that?
Sorry, that was the captain from the Claremont Police Department asking for my sister to come to the police station to talk to the Attorney General, and he said he'd like to strike this while it's still hot.
What does that mean?
I'm not really sure. That quote by itself is a little frustrating. I strike it while it's hot. I mean, yeah, I don't understand that at all.
So, Breida, has that statement become any clearer in the days that have passed since then?
No. So that statement was made. That was yesterday afternoon.
Oh,
so
okay.
This is recent. And again, I mean, the alleged attack happened weeks ago at this point. There's also been critique of a statement that the police chief made to the Valley News in one of their early articles about this. He said, talking about the alleged perpetrators, mistakes they make as a young child should not follow them for the rest of their life. So the family, you know, is saying, well, what about our son?
Yeah, wait a minute here. This
right.
is, this is Where not is
the,
done yet.
Is there bias that's was influencing or continues to influence this investigation?
Certainly a lot going on in the Upper Valley this week. And another thing happening this week was the shooting at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. Briefly, Breida, what happened there?
Right. So an older woman, a 70-year-old woman, was in intensive care there, and her son, Travis Frink from Rhode Island, he's 48 years old, came in with a concealed gun in a bag, allegedly, and shot her. It caused a massive police response, an active sort of the response for an active shooter there. People were told to shelter in place. There was a big evacuation. And he was charged in court this week with homicide.
We'll talk more about that scary moment on Tuesday when we started seeing reports of active shooter at Dartmouth-Hitchcock on Tuesday. Situation has been resolved. But in the wake of that, looking at hospital security, doing sort of a debrief on how the hospital handled the event. If you have questions or comments about this or other stories in the news this week, our lines are open. Give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post your comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with NHPR's Brita Green, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review, and Dean Spiliotis, Civic Scholar at the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU. A lot of voices around the table today, but we still want to hear yours. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Now, Brita, before the break, we started talking about the shooting at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. A man shot his mother in the intensive care unit and killed her. There were questions about what kind of security is required to get into an ICU like that. How did that even happen? How did a man with a gun get into the ICU?
Right. So my understanding is there aren't metal detectors when you enter the hospital. You can sign in as a member of the family. I believe that the patient then okays that, you know, that you are a member of the family. But, you know, at the news conference this week, what the hospital official says was they're reviewing all their policies, all their security policies, all their safety policies. They say that, you know, these incidents have happened at other hospitals in recent years, and it's sort of a standard procedure at this point that then the hospital will reflect and say, okay, do we need to have more hoops that you have to jump through to get into a hospital room?
So is there a process by which they're looking at that? And if so, when will they come out with any kind of recommendations or conclusions?
We don't know any details of that at this point.
It's interesting. You know, one of the nice things about that hospital complex is you can kind of come and go, and there are no metal detectors to get into the main part, no bag checks. I'm guessing that's probably going to change now, but that hospital has been very accessible from a number of different locations on the campus since it opened.
Yeah, the hospitals in the state have already been, for months, reviewing their security procedures, largely due to the fact that they're housing a large number of mental health patients in their emergency rooms that they haven't had to in the past. So the combination of this seemingly intractable problem of mental health patients having to be kept in emergency rooms for weeks at a time, combined with this recent incident, it wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing metal detectors and other enhanced security processes, unfortunately, in the hospitals.
Well, you typically don't think that the son of a patient in ICU is someone that you need to worry about, and so this obviously caught everybody completely by surprise.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, you mentioned mental health. We don't know the story about that yet, and not that you're making an accusation that there is a mental health issue here. But in court this week, the suspect pleaded not guilty.
I think the Associated Press had an interview with an uncle saying he was suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome.
I think at some point there was a court proceeding or something years ago in the divorce, I think, where his ex-wife was very concerned about his mental health and about a collection of weapons and knives and things like that. She was concerned that he still had them.
Okay, so that may be an issue that comes
there, yeah.
up. Okay. Let's talk about something else happening this week. Sunapee, a group of New Hampshire residents and sportsmen's organizations, is suing the Department of Environmental Services over boat access on Lake Sunapee. Brita, what's the background of the story?
Right. So this is a very ongoing, long saga. This is about what's known as the Wild Goose Site. It's a site that the state had been planning to put a public boat launch at. Earlier this year, Governor Sununu sort of pulled the plug on the whole thing by choosing not to renew a wetlands permit for the site. The Fish and Game Commission then pushed back with a public letter saying, you know, he was caving to the interests of wealthy residents around the lake. There was some pushback against that, as you can imagine. And now this is sort of the latest development in this, is that there's this lawsuit saying that the governor doesn't actually even have authority to take action on that wetlands permit either way.
Yeah, I've been a resident of that Sunapee area since I moved to New Hampshire in 1981, and this has been an issue that's pretty much been going on since then, this wild goose site. And I'll tell you that the reaction among people I've talked to is like saying basically it's just basically catering to these to this lakefront property owners by not allowing this site to happen, because, you know, Sunapee is, you know, one of the biggest lakes in New Hampshire, and there really is very little public boat access, and they've been trying to get some extra access for a long time.
But to that question about whether or not the governor is within his authority to do this, what in your experience tells you that he is?
I don't really understand I don't understand the legalisms of that, but it does seem kind of a little far-fetched to think that he could just say that he can actually issue or withdraw a wetlands permit.
Mm-hmm. But even if he did, Rita, you reported this week that some folks say that, yeah, maybe if he does have the authority, maybe he shouldn't, because he's an elected official and folks at the environmental department kind of know best.
Right. There's sort of two things here. I mean, one is, I reached out to the Department of Environmental Services. I did not hear back, but someone with that department did speak with the Valley News and said that it is routine that department will go to the governor's office for approval on high-profile projects. The second thing is sort of a step back, bigger picture political question, which is, should the governor, who's an elected official who is, you know, catering to voters year to year, have say over long-running environmental, natural resources, wildlife decisions in this state? We have a whole Fish and Game Department that is, you know, scientists, quote-unquote experts. Why are they not making those decisions?
It was fascinating to see Fish and Game come out so aggressively against the governor's position. And his relationship with the Fish and Game Department, a very prominent state agency, now featured on a reality TV show, by the way, is very tense. He overruled them on the execution of the bears, which was seen as a political decision, not one based really in wildlife science. And now they are coming out with all guns blazing, all members of the commission unanimously in a very strong letter against the governor's intervention in this matter, which they see as a priority to ensure some public access to the lake, one of the last large lakes in the state to which there is none.
There's no public access to Lake Sunapee?
At that.
There are, but it's such a large lake that there's really very limited access compared to places like Winnipesaukee and other.
I guess compared to other lakes.
Kind of depth of,
is the point.
And sort of the depth of the ramp for the size of the boat, and also parking these SUVs with trailers as well.
Yeah, there's nothing. There's very.
They want to put like 30 over 30 spaces for SUVs and trailers at this particular
a place where you can drive up a boat on a trailer. And
there are some. Exactly. Yeah, there are several.
And I think we should say, to be fair, that local residents, there's traffic concerns with the specific place that the site is in, and the governor has said that he's still committed to finding a way to have public access on this lake. He says he's going to come up with a better plan, is what he says.
All right. Well,
good luck to that.
Yeah. NHPR's Rita Green. Rita, thank you very much for joining us and sharing all this news from the Upper Valley. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. We're speaking with Dean Spiliotis of SNHU, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, and Jeff Feingold of New Hampshire Business Review. A few more stories to cover before the end of the hour, one of which is this headline in the Union Leader this week. I love this headline. Census. NH rolling in the dough.
Yeah.
Okay, so where's this headline coming from, Dave? Now, you didn't write this headline, did you?
But no, we don't write the headlines. We have the highest median income, and it's consistent with economic reports about New Hampshire historically, year after year. We have a high level of median income. We have low levels of unemployment. We have high levels of education. I think there'd still be a large number of people in the state who find that the report doesn't jibe with the day-to-day reality of their life, though, particularly if you're a low-skilled, underskilled worker in hospitality or retail, for instance.
Mm-hmm. So what does that mean for our economy, Jeff?
Well, actually, what Dave's right. We've had among the lowest or the lowest median incomes, per capita incomes, for decades now in the country, and it's basically a function of our population. We're an older population. We have a highly educated population in general, and that's median income reflects a median. You have to remember that. So there was an interesting study that came out just yesterday as well about from the New England Center for the Fiscal Policy Institute about our poverty rate, which is relatively low, and that's one of the reasons why we have such a high median income. But we have to remember we're talking about averages and medians, and if you go certainly up into the North Country, that this idea of this high per capita income, high median income, it doesn't wash. We're a small state, and averages and medians are reflective of the whole population. When there are segments of the population where it's not a reality.
You're making me feel like this information is useless, Jeff.
It's not actually. It's like New Hampshire is a wealthy state. And that is a fact. We have a lot of wealth in this state.
But, is the wealth distributed, or is it?
But the wealth is concentrated in certain parts of the state, for the most part, the southern part of the state. If you get north of the notches, as they say, it's less and less of a reality. And actually, in the parts of the western part of the state, we were talking about Claremont just a few minutes ago. That's a different picture. So it's a statewide picture. It's not a picture of what's going on in different pockets of the state.
Just to put a number on it, the median income, I think, was about $76,000. And median means that half the people are below that 76, half are above, half are below. It is unevenly distributed. I think the data I saw for COAS is that the county, the median income there is something like half of what it is statewide. So it is really variable around the state. The other issue is, critics say that, the reason why the median income is so high is because the state does not have a particularly deep social safety net for people who are experiencing poverty. They tend to live in either sort of move out of the state into other states with a bit like Massachusetts with a better safety net. And so that the numbers are kind of driven by the fact that you just have sort of fewer people from lower income levels staying in the state.
Yeah, but the bottom line is this is a very wealthy state.
Sure.
It's one of the wealthiest states in the country per capita, and that's a reality.
That 76,000 median looks awfully good against a national median of about 55.
Absolutely.
So that's hard to beat.
Yeah, and New England on the whole was doing pretty well too, according to the census. I mean, Connecticut was number 2, and Massachusetts was also in the number 5. So, hey, good for New England. I guess, right?
That's right.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and we've still got time to field your questions on a couple of things. One is Equifax. The other is Amazon possibly coming to New Hampshire. We'll see. The number 1-800-892-6477. Let's talk about Equifax, too, first. Jeff, New Hampshire Business Review reported this week that the state attorney general's office will probably be collaborating with counterparts in other states, looking into the massive Equifax security breach that has half the country freaked out. Which remind us what happened with Equifax?
Equifax is one of the three major credit reporting agencies, and it turns out that it was hacked. Their database was hacked into in July, and the personal information of about 143 million customers. Well, yeah, I guess to call them customers is a little extreme because they're not exactly going in there. They're not saying, "I want you to be my credit reporting agency." They have these names of 143 million people were stolen by hackers, including their social security numbers, their driver's license numbers in some cases, their names, just everything. And it took Equifax quite a while to report this to their customers, and their initial response actually after making it public was tepid is a little is too nice a way to say it. They basically actually try to make some money off of their customers by offering them
security for $5
exactly.
or something like that. Yeah. So what might the attorney general be looking at for this?
The bottom line is that 622,000 New Hampshire people are on that list.
More than half the state.
More than half the state is on that list, including actually the deputy attorney general, assistant attorney general we spoke to, James Buffetti, who runs the Consumer Protection Bureau of the state. He's on that list, so he has a personal interest in this, I guess. But it seems that there's going to be a nationwide attempt by attorneys general to go after Equifax on this. I know that Maura Healey, the AG down in Massachusetts, is already talking about filing a lawsuit. New Hampshire is definitely, maybe not definitely, but likely to enter at least an investigation into what's going on here, which might be a precursor to getting into a lawsuit against Equifax. Equifax right now is in a major mess right now. Its stock price has just tumbled, and it's in a permanent, seems to be in a permanent PR crisis, because they've, everything they try to do is just not right in terms of public relations. And it's a point where we're headed in a direction where I believe it's going to be a massive lawsuit on the part of the states, at least, and there'll be federal congressional hearings on this, and it's a very disturbing situation.
One more news story before we close out this weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and that is Amazon. Right? Amazon was looking for a second headquarters. They've got one in Seattle. They wanted to find a second one, and some folks in New Hampshire are trying for it. A group on the seacoast is making the effort. What's the argument for putting Amazon's second headquarters in New Hampshire?
Well, we do meet their criteria of being within a certain distance of a million population metropolitan area by virtue of Boston. Portsmouth has got that tech quality, some relative cool that they're looking for in a working environment. The state has got a quality of life to offer potential employees. They've got all the transportation infrastructure there that they would need, with the Pease Trade Port, the Port of New Hampshire, rail connections, the major interstate highways. I think they could make a fairly good argument.
Yeah, actually, it's people in Portsmouth who are driving this. They set up a petition. They want to get people to the state to apply to this, or let their names be known. But the reality is, we're talking about 50,000 employees coming in. We have a hard enough time filling the jobs we have now. So
right, we need bus drivers.
And also the real reality is. You know? It's not even just the jobs. It's right now we have no place where people could live.
Right. Housing.
50,000 new people, and it's nice to think that New Hampshire might be in the running, but the reality is, I wouldn't hold my breath on it. Let's put it that way.
I think right now any location would be hard pressed coming up with 50,000 employees and housing for them on short notice, but New Hampshire particularly so.
Well, yeah. The New York Times did a great graphic, sort of whittling down all the possible areas, and they ended up with Boston came close. It was between Boston, D.C., and Denver, but Denver ultimately won out in part because of incentives that they could offer, but New Hampshire apparently doesn't offer
incentives. New Hampshire doesn't offer tax incentives at all, and that's one of the other reasons why New Hampshire will have a hard time doing this. I mean, Boston gave all kinds of incentives to General Electric to move their headquarters there, and they seem to be willing to do the same thing for Amazon, but New Hampshire doesn't do that.
Duh. I guess that's all I could say
about
that.
Well, we're one of the richest states. We could cough up some dough.
At least there's that, right? At least we have the census data
to show how great we are. That's right.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us for the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. That's Jeff Feingold from the New Hampshire Business Review, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, and Dean Spiliotis with us, as always, from SNHU. And with you, of course, thank you for your questions or comments today, listeners. And the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.